Chapter 11. Everything seemed so quiet and peaceful that they retired as usual. All night they were disturbed by a lot of drumming in the villages. A deep, rapid roll nearby would be followed by another far off, then all ceased. Soon short appeals would rattle out here and there, then all mingle together, increase, become vigorous and sustained, would spread out over the forest, roll through the night, unbroken and ceaseless, near and far, as if the whole land had been one immense drum booming out steadily an appeal to heaven. And through the deep and tremendous noise sudden yells that resembled snatches of songs from a madhouse started shrill, and high in discordant jets of sound which seemed to rush far above the earth, and drive all peace from under the stars. Carlier and Kaertz slept badly. They both thought they had heard shots fired during the night, but they could not agree as to the direction. In the morning Makola was gone somewhere. He returned about noon with one of yesterday's strangers, and eluded all Kaertz's attempts to close with him. Had become deaf apparently. Kaertz wondered. Carlier, who had been fishing off the bank, came back and remarked, while he showed his catch, "The nigger seemed to be in a deuce of a stir. I wonder what's up. I saw about 15 canoes cross the river during the 2 hours I was there fishing." Kaertz, worried, said, "Isn't this Makola very queer today?" Carlier advised, "Keep all our men together in case of some trouble." Two, there were 10 station men who had been left by the director. Those fellows, having engaged themselves to the company for 6 months without having any idea of a month in particular, and only a very faint notion of time in general, had been serving the cause of progress for upwards of 2 years. Belonging to a tribe from a very distant part of the land of darkness and sorrow, they did not run away, naturally supposing that as wandering strangers they would be killed by the inhabitants of the country, in which they were right. They lived in straw huts on the slope of a ravine overgrown with reedy grass, just behind the station buildings. They were not happy, regretting the festive incantations, the sorceries, the human sacrifices of their own land, where they also had parents, brothers, sisters, admired chiefs, respected magicians, loved friends, and other ties supposed generally to be human. Besides, the rice ration served out by the company did not agree with them, being a food unknown to their land, and to which they could not get used. Consequently, they were unhealthy and miserable. Had they been of any other tribe, they would have made up their minds. To die for nothing is easier to certain savages than suicide, and so have escaped from the puzzling difficulties of existence. But belonging, as they did, to a warlike tribe with filed teeth, they had more grit, and went on stupidly living through disease and sorrow. They did very little work, and had lost their splendid physique. Carlier and Kaertz doctored them assiduously without being able to bring them back into condition again. They were mustered every morning, and told off to different tasks: grass cutting, fence building, tree felling, and sea, which no power on earth could induce them to execute efficiently. The two whites had practically very little control over them. In the afternoon Makola came over to the big house, and found Kaertz watching three heavy columns of smoke rising above the forests. "What is that?" asked Kaertz. "Some villages burn," answered Makola, who seemed to have regained his wits. Then he said abruptly, "We have got very little ivory. Bad 6 months trading. Do you like get a little more ivory?" "Yes," said Kaertz, eagerly. He thought of percentages which were low. "Those men who came yesterday are traders from Londa who have got more ivory than they can carry home. Shall I buy? I know their camp." "Certainly," said Kaertz. "What are those traders?" "Bad fellows," said Makola, indifferently. "They fight with people, and catch women and children. They are bad men, and got guns. There is a great disturbance in the country. Do you want ivory?" "Yes," said Kaertz. Makola said nothing for a while. Then, "Those workmen of ours are no good at all," he muttered, looking round. Station in very bad order, sir. Director will growl. Better get a fine lot of ivory, then he say nothing. I can't help it. The men won't work, said Kayers. W, when will you get that ivory? Very soon, said McCullough. P perhaps tonight. You leave it to me, and keep indoors, sir. I think you had better give some palm wine to our men, to make a dance this evening. Enjoy themselves. Work better tomorrow. There's plenty palm wine gone a little sour. Kayert said, S, and McCullough, with his own hands, carried big calabashes to the door of his hut. They stood there till the evening, and Mrs. McCullough looked into every one. The men got them at sunset. When Kayert and Carlier retired, a big bonfire was flaring before the men's huts. They could hear their shouts and drumming. Some men from Gabilla's village had joined the station hands, and the entertainment was a great success. In the middle of the night, Carlier waking suddenly, heard a man shout loudly, then a shot was fired. Only one. Carlier ran out and met Kayerts on the veranda. They were both startled. As they went across the yard to call McCullough, they saw shadows moving in the night. One of them cried, "Don't shoot! It's me, Price!" Then McCullough appeared close to them. "Gee, go back please," he urged. "You spoil all dot there are strange men about," said Carlier. "And never mind, I know," said McCullough. Then he whispered, "All right, bring ivory. Say nothing, I know my business." The two white men reluctantly went back to the house, but did not sleep. They heard footsteps, whispers, some groans. It seemed as if a lot of men came in, dumped heavy things on the ground, squabbled a long time, then went away. They lay on their hard beds and thought, "Colin, this McCullough's invaluable." In the morning Carlier came out, very sleepy, and pulled at the cord of the big bell. The station hands mustered every morning to the sound of the bell. That morning nobody came. Kayerts turned out also, yawning. Across the yard they saw McCullough come out of his hut, a tin basin of soapy water in his hand. McCullough, a civilized nigger, was very neat in his person. He threw the soaps it skillfully over a wretched little yellow cur he had, then turning his face to the agent's house, he shouted from the distance, "All the men gone last night." They heard him plainly, but in their surprise they both yelled out together, "Colin, what?" Then they stared at one another. "We are in a proper fix now," growled Carlier. "Aye, it's incredible," muttered Kayerts. "I will go to the huts and see," said Carlier, striding off. McCullough coming up found Kayerts standing alone. "I can hardly believe it," said Kayerts, tearfully. "W, we took care of them, as if they had been our children." "They went with the coast people," said McCullough after a moment of hesitation. "What do I care with whom they went, the ungrateful brutes!" exclaimed the other. Then with sudden suspicion, and looking hard at McCullough, he added, "Colin, what do you know about it?" McCullough moved his shoulders, looking down on the ground. "W, what do I know? I think only. Will you come, and look at the ivory I've got there? It is a fine lot. You never saw such." He moved towards the store. Kayerts followed him mechanically, thinking about the incredible desertion of the men. On the ground before the door of the fetish, lay six splendid tusks. "What did you give for it?" asked Kayerts, after surveying the lot with satisfaction. "No regular trade," said McCullough. "They brought the ivory, and gave it to me. I told them to take what they most wanted in the station. It is a beautiful lot. No station can show such tusks. Those traders wanted carriers badly, and our men were no good here. No trade, no entry in books. All correct." Kayerts nearly burst with indignation. "W.Y.," he shouted, "I believe you have sold our men for these tusks." McCullough stood impassive and silent. I will I," stuttered Kayerts. "You fiend," he yelled out. "I did the best for you and the company," said McCullough, imperturbably. "Why you shout so much? Look at this tusk. I dismiss you. I will report you. I won't look at the tusk. I forbid you to touch them. I order you to throw them into the river. You very red, Mr. Kurtz. If you are so irritable in the sun, you will get fever and die like the first chief, pronounced McCullough impressively. They stood still, contemplating one another with intense eyes, as if they had been looking with effort across immense distances. Kurtz shivered. McCullough had meant no more than he said, but his words seemed to Kurtz full of ominous menace. He turned sharply and went away to the house. McCullough retired into the bosom of his family, and the tusks, left lying before the store, looked very large and valuable in the sunshine. Carlier came back on the veranda. "Tea, they're all gone, hey?" asked Kurtz from the far end of the common room in a muffled voice. "Why, you did not find anybody?" "Oh, yes," said Carlier, "I found one of Gabilla's people lying dead before the huts shot through the body. We heard that shot last night." Kurtz came out quickly. He found his companion staring grimly over the yard at the tusks, away by the store. They both sat in silence for a while. Then Kurtz related his conversation with McCullough. Carlier said nothing. At the midday meal they ate very little. They hardly exchanged a word that day. A great silence seemed to lie heavily over the station and press on their lips. McCullough did not open the store. He spent the day playing with his children. He lay full length on a mat outside his door, and the youngsters sat on his chest and clambered all over him. It was a touching picture. Mrs. McCullough was busy cooking all day, as usual. The white men made a somewhat better meal in the evening. Afterwards, Carlier, smoking his pipe, strolled over to the store. He stood for a long time over the tusks, touched one or two with his foot, even tried to lift the largest one by its small end. He came back to his chief, who had not stirred from the veranda, threw himself in the chair and said, "I can see it. They were pounced upon while they slept heavily, after drinking all that palm wine you've allowed McCullough to give them. A put-up job. See? The worst is, some of Gabilla's people were there, and got carried off too, no doubt. The least drunk woke up, and got shot for his sobriety. This is a funny country. What will you do now?" "We can't touch it, of course," said Kurtz. "Of course not," assented Carlier. "Slavery is an awful thing," stammered out Kurtz, in an unsteady voice. "Frightful the sufferings," grunted Carlier with conviction. They believed their words. Everybody shows a respectful deference to certain sounds that he and his fellows can make. But about feelings, people really know nothing. We talk with indignation or enthusiasm. We talk about oppression, cruelty, crime, devotion, self-sacrifice, virtue, and we know nothing real beyond the words. Nobody knows what suffering or sacrifice mean except, perhaps, the victims of the mysterious purpose of these illusions. Next morning they saw McCullough very busy setting up in the yard the big scales used for weighing ivory. By and by Carlier said, "Colin, what's that filthy scoundrel up to?" and lounged out into the yard. Kurtz followed. They stood watching. McCullough took no notice. When the balance was swung true, he tried to lift a tusk into the scale. It was too heavy. He looked up helplessly without a word, and for a minute they stood round that balance as mute and still as three statues. Suddenly Carlier said, "Colin, catch hold of the other end, McCullough, you beast." And together they swung the tusk up. Kurtz trembled in every limb. He muttered, "I say. Oh. I say." And putting his hand in his pocket found there a dirty bit of paper and the stump of a pencil. He turned his back on the others, as if about to do something tricky, and noted stealthily the weights which Carlier shouted out to him with unnecessary loudness. When all was over, McCullough whispered to himself, "The sun's very strong here for the tusks." Carlier said to Kurtz, in a careless tone, "Colin, I say, chief, I might just as well give him a lift with this lot into the store." As they were going back to the house, Kurtz observed with a sigh, "It had to be done." and Carlier said, colon, it's deplorable, but, the men being company's men, the ivory is company's ivory. We must look after it. I will report to the director, of course, said Kurtz. Of course, let him decide, approved Carlier. At midday they made a hearty meal. Kurtz sighed from time to time. Whenever they mentioned McCullough's name, they always added to it an opprobrious epithet. It eased their conscience. McCullough gave himself a half holiday and bathed his children in the river. No one from Gabilla's villages came near the station that day. No one came the next day, and the next, nor for a whole week. Gabilla's people might have been dead and buried for any sign of life they gave. But they were only mourning for those they had lost by the witchcraft of white men, who had brought wicked people into their country. The wicked people were gone, but fear remained. Fear always remains. A man may destroy everything within himself, love and hate and belief, and even doubt, but as long as he clings to life he cannot destroy fear. The fear, subtle, indestructible, and terrible, that pervades his being, that tinges his thoughts, that lurks in his heart, that watches on his lips the struggle of his last breath. In his fear, the mild old Gabilla offered extra human sacrifices to all the evil spirits that had taken possession of his white friends. His heart was heavy. Some warriors spoke about burning and killing, but the cautious old savage dissuaded them. Who could foresee the woe those mysterious creatures, if irritated, might bring? They should be left alone. Perhaps in time they would disappear into the earth as the first one had disappeared. His people must keep away from them, and hope for the best. Kurtz and Carlier did not disappear, but remained above on this earth, that, somehow, they fancied had become bigger and very empty. It was not the absolute and dumb solitude of the post that impressed them, so much as an inarticulate feeling that something from within them was gone, something that worked for their safety and had kept the wilderness from interfering with their hearts. The images of home, the memory of people like them, of men that thought and felt as they used to think and feel, receded into distances made indistinct by the glare of unclouded sunshine. And out of the great silence of the surrounding wilderness, its very hopelessness and savagery seemed to approach them nearer, to draw them gently, to look upon them, to envelop them with a solicitude irresistible, familiar, and disgusting. Days lengthened into weeks, then into months. Gabilla's people drummed and yelled to every new moon, as of yore, but kept away from the station. McCullough and Carlier tried once in a canoe to open communications, but were received with a shower of arrows, and had to fly back to the station for dear life. That attempt set the country up and down the river into an uproar that could be very distinctly heard for days. The steamer was late. At first they spoke of delay jauntily, then anxiously, then gloomily. The matter was becoming serious. Stores were running short. Carlier cast his lines off the bank, but the river was low, and the fish kept out in the stream. They dared not stroll far away from the station to shoot. Moreover, there was no game in the impenetrable forest. Once Carlier shot a hippo in the river. They had no boat to secure it, and it sank. When it floated up, it drifted away, and Gabilla's people secured the carcass. It was the occasion for a national holiday, but Carlier had a fit of rage over it, and talked about the necessity of exterminating all the niggers before the country could be made habitable. Kurtz mooned about silently, spent hours looking at the portrait of his mealy. It represented a little Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.